Every day, your brain tries to make sense of the world around you. Approximately every 2 seconds, your brain is forced to make a certain decision, amounting to about 35,000 decisions on a daily basis. Your brain is constantly working, processing, judging, evaluating, and finally interpreting your perceptions of the world, accompanied by your sensory experiences. Fascinatingly and luckily, your brain is doing most of its work outside of your conscious awareness. In fact, most of human cognition, so all the mental processes like attention, perception, reasoning, consciousness, memory, that help you process and understand, store and retrieve information, make decisions and produce appropriate responses, is unconscious. Human cognition is captivating. It's enthralling. It's universal, but also unique. Welcome to another episode of Brain and Butter, a glimpse into your personal cognition.
We are here to share the fascinating workings of our brains and connect them to implications they have for each of us individually and for society as a whole. If you want to know more about the vision behind our podcast, give our intro episode on Spotify and Apple Podcast a listen and follow us on Instagram, where we go more in depth with our intentions for brain and butter.
In the theme of our episode, Austin and I will dive into the universality and uniqueness of human cognition and link it to identity and personality. We will also touch upon enhancing cognition through brain stimulation. To go deep into the subject matter, I'm excited to welcome our guest today, expert in the field of cognitive neuroscience, Dr. Ilya Slichte. Ilya, great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Ilya, to tell a little bit about you, you have a PhD in neuroscience, and since 2014, you work as an assistant professor of cognitive neuroscience at the Department of Brain and Cognition at the University of Amsterdam. Your main research focus is on the brain mechanisms underlying visual, sensory, and working memory, as well as consciousness. Your lab work also entails brain stimulation to investigate the possibilities of enhancing cognition using several methods like transcranial magnetic stimulation, or short TMS, a non-invasive tool that uses magnetic fields to produce electric currents which stimulate brain areas to, for example, improve symptoms of depression.
Besides your work at the university, 2016 you also launched your own company, Brains First. Brains First is a talent assessment company that measures cognitive functions, natural talents, and the skills of our brains by administering gamified tests, literally video games, to produce unbiased answers that can't be faked. Like on a questionnaire, for example, that can easily be faked. Many of us despise classical paper tests, especially of the IQ test form, so this advancement of assessment on a cognitive level is groundbreaking. Brains First is then able to establish cognitive profiles to predict human performance in a wide range of jobs and athletics. Ilya, it's amazing how you've applied cognitive functioning to help predict career outcomes and talent acquisition. Super cool.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I briefly described what human cognition entails, but when we talk about a cognitive profile like you do at Brains First, what do we mean by it? Can you describe a bit what functions of cognition define the cognitive profile of an individual?
Sure, I can. And I think if it concerns the cognitive profiling that we are doing, we stick to what is called the executive functions. These executive functions are functions that are predominantly produced by the prefrontal cortex, a typical human part of the brain, much bigger in humans than our species. And also something that you develop over the course of your life, specifically between age 8 and 20, we see a huge improvement in these executive functions. So if I'm talking about what do we mean by these typical prefrontal executive functions, It's about three aspects of it. It's about working memory. If I explain what working memory is, it's about the mind's eye or the mind's ear, so to say. So you keep information online in your conscious mind in working memory to use it for thinking, for deciding, these kind of typical what Kahneman calls system two processes that are clearly conscious. Working memory enables you for any specific task that you need to do, for example, during work, what do you need to do? When do you need to do it? How do you need to do it? So all these kinds of task instructions to get up to the next level and use the information that you need at the same time. Working memory, I think, is at the core of what we're measuring. Because from working memory, you can direct attention, like what to focus on. And also inhibition or the mental break, what not to focus attention on. So that's kind of the shadow side of attention, as you can see it. But you also need inhibition when you're working on a task and then the mind pops out, you're getting bored, you want to do something else instead of completing the task. So you need to suppress your own mind, stay on the task and not think of something else. So inhibition in itself is also something very crucial at the core of these executive functions. And finally, we measure cognitive flexibility or mental flexibility. If you kind of am used to do tasks in a specific way, and then suddenly it doesn't work anymore, maybe you need to stop, rethink, adjust your working memory content, and try a different approach. Or you need to pull somebody else into the thinking process, ask for advice and do things differently. So that's the core of what we're measuring. When we're talking about an executive function profile, that's actually what it is. So it's not all the aspects of cognition that we're measuring, but working memory, attention, inhibition, and cognitive flexibility.
And to give an example of some of these cognitive profiles that we found, some of my skills after taking one of the cognitive profile tests at Brains First, I scored high in consistency. That's the ability to maintain while doing repetitive work. And next, I got high in grit, and that's the ability to keep performing under pressure, as well as capacity. And that's the ability to access information simultaneously while keeping it in mind, retrieving it, and applying it to combine it.
Yeah, well, do you want me to comment on your cognitive profile?
I would love to hear that, yeah? Actually.
Yes. So, as I told before, we measure working memory, attention, inhibition, and cognitive flexibility. And we based all our tests on existing scientific articles, and we gamified that. And based on that, we actually measure working memory aspects in many different ways. So we have many different theoretical concepts, but also for inhibition, cognitive flexibility, and attention. So when looking at your cognitive profile, to start with the consistency, that's something that we measure in the inhibition task. And that actually means that you almost scored 100% correct during that task. We really push you to be as fast as possible, but it's evident that you refuse to do that. So in these very simple tasks, it seems that, well, you're nitty-gritty perfectionist in that aspect. You don't allow yourself to make mistakes. When it comes down to grit, that's in our second game, where we actually make the task so difficult that, well, everybody fails within minutes, and you actually persist there. So you show that you don't easily give up. You you keep pushing yourself to make the most of this, and this is something quite extraordinary, high scores that we see here. And finally, your capacity or your working memory capacity. So how much information can you juggle online in your conscious mind at the same time? It's quite, well, it's actually extremely high if I look at it. So in that sense, you can keep lots of information online consciously and link that to each other. So probably that makes you good at analytical thinking and creative processes.
This is so interesting, and yeah, I'm wondering, to what extent is the cognitive profile, as you described, for example, now in an example of Austin, to what extent is it predetermined or, let's say, stable? And to what extent is it actually dynamic and shapeable?
So there's actually two answers that I need to give here. If we're talking about us being adults, the cognitive profile is quite stable when we're between age 20 and age 35. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, especially if it comes down to like how fast everything works in terms of the executive functions, it already goes down. And in specific jobs, for example, if we're talking about elite football players or very fast traders, for example, then you actually already go into retirement because your brain is not fast enough to deal with the pace of the work that requires a very fast mind. Mm-hmm. Between age 8 and 20, we see a huge increase in working memory capacity. We see a huge development in terms of inhibition and attention. Mm-hmm. So that's actually the where it matters most that you get enough stimulation. And what do I mean with stimulation? I think it's a diversity thing. So we tend to focus on school abilities, math, reading, writing, these kinds of things, at the same time playing music, doing sports, draw, create some art, whatever, that's all important to develop the executive functions. So if you're talking about, is it predetermined? Yes, there's a strong genetic factor in there. If mm-hmm. you look at working memory capacity, it seems to be quite correlated with the working memory capacity of your parents.
Okay.
You do need to correct for age here because they already have a slightly lower working memory capacity because of the decline with age.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's all about this environment interaction with mm-hmm. your genes. So you need to have a rich environment where you do lots of different things to build up the best possible executive functions belonging to you.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite predetermined. It's quite stable across time when we're talking between age 20 and 35. You can maintain it for quite a long period up to at an old age. If you still do lots of diverse things, if you retire, for example. So you need to go out to the cinema, you need to go out to concerts, you need to see friends, go on holiday, play some bridge maybe, do all these different things to maintain a high-functioning prefrontal cortex and its associated executive functions.
That's super interesting. So you say basically on a general level between the age of 20 and 35, it's pretty stable, the cognitive mm-hmm. profile, and declines.
Yeah.
And that's a universal phenomena that mm-hmm. we observe. But I am wondering, because you talk about how crucial also environmental influences are and the interaction with the environment. Mm-hmm. So would it be possible, if we take Austin's cognitive profile now, that if he would completely change, let's say, his environmental influences, that he could develop a very different cognitive profile after some years, just because he's been, you know, interacting with a different environment?
Well, first of all, all the research that has been done into cognitive training provides some clues where this is possible or not. And I do have to say that cognitive training usually is computer-based training. So it's not really this kind of enriched environment that you want to use for cognition training. And there you see a couple of percent change in executive function. Mm-hmm. So it is possible to train it a bit, but it's fairly limited, if you would ask me. Okay. Then again, if we're talking about stability and shapeability, we do know that the executive functions decline massively when you get into a depressive episode or if you get a burnout, for example. So it does change and it is associated with specific states of mind, so to say. So it is changeable, but you kind of change into, not you anymore, right? You cannot use the prefrontal part of your brain anymore to the same extent as before. So it is shapeable. And if you haven't slept well and then we test you on concentration span, you do very poorly. So some of these things are more state related. Some of the aspects are more trait related, so more stable over time.
Excellent. And how unique or how similar are our cognitive profiles?
Wow, that's a big question. And I think in terms of like looking at these, we see common kind of patterns in the cognitive profiles. Typically, we see that people with high working memory capacity also have high reaction time speed, so they're fast. And have an efficient, their attention works quite efficiently. So in that sense, that's a common profile that we see. At the same time, when looking at, for example, at your profile, you're quite perfectionist, so more leaning towards doing things correctly instead of doing things in a fast way. While at the same time having a high working memory capacity. So that's not a common pattern that we see. So actually, we see quite some diversity there in the cognitive profiles. Also, when looking at the cognitive profile of an individual, we typically see very high highs on specific aspects, very low lows on our aspects, and that actually makes you more suitable for one kind of job over the other, or makes you more suitable to, well, nobody should do multitasking anyway, so I highly advise everybody to start monotasking, but you specifically are very bad at multitasking when looking at your cognitive profile. So do one thing at a time, limit the amount of information that you use when going through a task. So you don't want to divide attention that much. You don't want to switch tasks all the time. Just stick to one task, complete it, and then go to the next. So yes, we can... I think there's quite some differences, I would say, between cognitive profiles, and that actually makes each person quite unique in what works for them and what doesn't work for them.
Super cool, and yeah, I love the way that you talk about Austin's cognitive profile. For me, it seems you actually directly link it to some sort of his personality or identity. You speak about Austin tends to be like a perfectionist, and I'm actually wondering, would you say that the personality or identity of a person is to be found in his or her cognitive profile? Because when I look at personality research or how we commonly talk about it in everyday matters, there's these big personality tests or inventories, like the Big Five and the Higsaco, that are very popular nowadays. And they talk about personality traits, like, for example, your extroversion level, your openness to experience, your conscientiousness. Do you think the personality of a person is, to some extent, or maybe even entirely, found in the cognitive profile of a person?
So first of all, I would like to say that I think executive functions are something completely different than what we measure with personality tests. So first and foremost, these cognitive profiles are about your thinking ability, right? So it's in that sense a bit cold, emotionless. It's about how you process information mainly in a task-oriented way. If we're talking about personality, it's about more social, emotional behavior and your tendency to behave in a specific social, emotional context. So it's something completely different. Also, if we look at the brain, it's housed somewhere else. So it's more like the temporal lobe, I would say. So it's something different. We also looked at this specifically, like can we, for the German air traffic control, we looked at links between personality and cognition, and we actually see very, very low correlations between someone's cognitive profile and the personality profile.
Okay.
So all the correlations are below, I would say, 0.08. So it's quite low. Yeah. So no link, well, I cannot claim no link, but there's a minor or tiny link between the two.
I actually wouldn't have expected that. That for me comes a bit as a surprise.
Why?
Well, I can imagine that certain personality profiles, they call for different abilities. Like when I think about attention, for example, you can really focus your attention on a specific object and have very narrow attention, or you can divide it across space, right? And I would assume that, say, a person that's very social and very good in social interactions and conversations is very good at dividing attention, so basically across a larger span and being able to respond to and take into consideration different people when speaking, for example, in a group of people. I would maybe link that to extroversion and think about, okay, that could be like you're very much able to spread your attention.
I understand where you're going, but at the same time, like take an extrovert, for example, an extrovert that cannot divide attention well, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So therefore, when being faced with, well, a party or a crowd of people, you would basically send information, not divide your attention to the crowd and see what you get back. So it's mainly you as an actor instead of somebody who actually really responds to what's happening in the environment. At the same time, you could have an introvert that really has this kind of ability to read the audience, so to say, and still doesn't act out on that. So I think it could be complementary, that if you have both aspects, that it's maybe a better combination to have. Mm-hmm. But to link one to the other, we don't see any statistical evidence for that.
This makes sense, because if you try to, you know, reduce human personality and human interactions to a set number of parameters, you start to run out of differences that can explain this wide variety of different human behaviors that we see in the world. So if you have all of these different cognitive profiles and then this personality on a different domain, then you could see why we get seemingly so vastly different acting people, even though there's only a finite number of different variables that we can be different in.
That's true. Like it allows for a lot more combinations that can come about and shape and define the different behaviors.
Well, don't misunderstand me on this part. I think that like your thinking ability or your executive function profile is very important for task-related work environments.
Yes.
I think personality still comes into play and is important in specific settings. So we also see that for air traffic control. Like I think cognitive abilities are very important and a very specific set there. But you do need to have a specific personality profile kind of be unsettled when planes are about to collide, because you need to maintain your cool and act on it. And if you don't have the right personality profile there, accidents are going to happen.
I would actually like to continue on to a different theme, brain stimulation, that you're also doing research on. And Yeah, could you briefly explain what you can do with brain stimulation in terms of enhancing cognition?
Yes, but I do need to explain a bit about what brain stimulation is,
yes.
Because most people actually think about electroconvulsive therapy, putting your car battery to your skull and then pushing major currents through the brain. That's not what we're talking about here. Nowadays, we mostly use transcranial magnetic stimulation. This is basically a very strong magnet that you put to the skull of a person. And then there's a very large current running through the coil, producing focused electrical activity in the brain tissue beneath the skull. And this is about a cubic centimeter. That's about the volume that you stimulate with this TMS coil, or the magnetic brain stimulation coil. So that's a very common technique, and it's very reliable. It's commonly used, for example, to treat depression nowadays. And we have electrical current stimulation, or transcranial electrical current stimulation. It's basically a 9-volt battery that you attach to two sides of your skull, and then you let an electrical current run between the plus and the minus of the battery. And then you actually run some current through the brain. Mm-hmm. It's much less precise. And the experimental results with this latter method is actually quite mixed. So does it actually work? That's one mm-hmm. of the key questions out there right now. So, and I think, to come back to your question, I have used both methods, mm-hmm. But I'm a great fan of transcranial magnetic stimulation. You can knock out, for example, the speech area of the brain. I just did it a couple of seconds ago, so therefore the stutter.
Really? But not on yourself.
No. So that's typically, you interfere with the ongoing activity in the brain. If you put it on the speech area of your brain and you're speaking, then you cannot produce clear speech anymore. But there's also other kinds of methods where you, for example, use theta burst stimulation. It's basically 40 seconds of stimulation, about 600 pulses. And then you can alter brain activity for about half an hour afterwards. With different protocols, you can raise activity in the underlying brain region, or you can lower brain activity in that brain region, and it has consequences to your behavior.
It's actually crazy.
What might one of these consequences to behavior look like? Can you give us an example?
I could give 10 different examples, but let me stick to a study that I've done with Karsten de Dreux a couple of years ago. We wrote a paper in 2016, and what we did there is we specifically targeted a region in the prefrontal cortex that takes care of inhibition, or the mental break. Mm-hmm. We raised inhibition with a specific TMS protocol, and then we had people play a negotiation game against mm-hmm. another person, and the pattern of responses that we saw, they were way more strategic in this negotiation game after like raising activity in this mental break area. Hmm. And we had the same people come back for a second time. And then we actually lowered activity in the same brain region, had mm-hmm. them do the same game, negotiation game, against somebody else. And then we actually saw much more aggressive behavior. Wow. So taking away the mental break gives rise to this aggressive tendency. Mm-hmm. And if you raise the break, it gives rise to more like strategic negotiation mm-hmm. strategies. And we also had a placebo condition where actually the brain activity shouldn't change. And we mm-hmm. also didn't see any changes in behavior in that condition. Mm-hmm. So that shows that if you interfere with specific regions in the brain, then you could get real life consequences for that. Mm-hmm. So next time I'm going into a negotiation deal, I would probably erase my mental break, the region of the break.
It's obviously a very powerful method. Where do you see the future of brain stimulation moving forward to? Like, what can it be used for in the future? How can it benefit cognition?
Well, there's a lot of different applications. So I use it in collaboration with psychiatrists to treat people with severe depression. So that's a possibility. There's several clinical trials within prison, for example, where you stimulate parts of the brain with electrical brain stimulation to actually counter aggressive tendencies with actually mm-hmm. quite some success. The ethical question is, do you want to apply that against people's will or not? But that's a different kind of topic. But you can change how the brain functions itself directly by interfering with its activity. In that sense, I think the possibilities are quite endless. And the key question is, do you actually want to do this, right? Like, do you want to stimulate a brain to be focused for a longer period of time? Mm-hmm. Or do you want a soldier with a sniper rifle to be more accurate in their shooting? So that's the other kind of application that you can think of. Yeah. And the question is, do you actually want to do that? Do we want to optimize ourselves using this kind of technology? And I think, well, in some cases, you might want to do that. Like, we don't want to walk towards everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. We drive a car because we want to go faster. So in specific circumstances, you might want to use it yourself, but there is, of course, a risk that your employer wants you to put on your brain stimulation set when starting to work.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, a road that we don't want to go down.
Yeah. Very philosophical and ethical question, I think. How long lasting are the changes that you can actually induce with brain stimulation in brain activity?
Like, on a molecular basis, you can see changes up to 72 hours after the brain stimulation. If we're really talking about impact on actual behavior, you typically see that it happens within the hour after brain stimulation. So it's fairly limited in time, I would say. This is a good thing when using test subjects at the psychology lab, because mm-hmm. you don't want to change their brain forever. At the same time, the downsides is that like, treatment with brain stimulation for people with depression is much harder and requires many, many, many sessions to actually produce a longer lasting change.
Have you or anyone else that you know of experimented with prolonged exposure to TMS?
Well, there's some safety issues here, right?
Yeah.
And in specific treatments, you actually want to induce an epileptic seizure in specific patient groups. So you can evoke an epileptic seizure in any person if you use TMS for a prolonged period of time with very high intensity, very high stimulation intensities. When you take the accurate precautions, this hardly ever happens. So then it mm-hmm. happens in less than 1 in 20,000 people. So the key question is, do you want to push the boundaries and then see when it fails, right? Mm-hmm. In certain circumstances with certain patient groups, maybe yes, but in for scientific research, definitely no.
Yeah.
And what are the reports of people whose brains have been stimulated? Have you experienced that people feel very differently, or maybe even have experiences, like out-of-body experiences, or where they report to feel like they are standing next to themselves, so to say?
Those things have been reported in the past, but I've never played around with these protocols, unfortunately. So, but the easy thing is stimulate the motor regions of your brain, you start to move immediately, right? So it's quite evident that it works. If you, for example, put magnetic stimulation on the frontal part of the brain, you don't really notice anything that much, but you do get more dopamine release. So it feels a bit good afterwards. So I have heard stories about scientists that actually are addicted to their own brain stimulation because it gives off this kind of dopamine shot.
I was wondering if there might be recreational uses for TMS, such as almost like using it like drugs in a sense, or
I think the machine itself has so much copper in it, it's almost unaffordable to most people. Like the electrical brain stimulation, you can build it yourself for about $10, €10. Mm-hmm. So that's easy to experiment with yourself. But I would advise people not to do it because they tend to get burns and not so much of brain stimulation.
Quite the risk indeed.
I love where this conversation is going, and I would love to actually continue our conversation into infinity, but I think there's lots to digest and take home for our listeners already. Thank you so much, Ilya, for so many valuable insights into human cognition, and I think in the end, human cognition is very complex, it's relatively stable, and it allows for a lot of uniqueness, which I love, and I hope that you at home can take away a lot of new insights.
To our listeners, thank you so much for listening to Brain and Butter. We hope you learned something new about your unique cognitive profile linked to your identity and personality, and how the brain works. We've a lot planned for this podcast, so if you're interested in brain insights that influence all areas of your life, stick around.